This is Phil Ferrand, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's a sad day, I tell you. It's a sad day. Got me some first world problems here. Oh, sad day. I just called Verizon, basically said, yeah. That was it. Oh, so Verizon puts out this unlimited plan because they're getting their lunch at by everybody else that has an unlimited plan. And now they're really getting their data network eaten up because they've offered people an unlimited plan. So we switched over just really early on. I mean, as soon as it said unlimited, I went, yep, pushed the button. Couple of months later, they went, wait a minute. We didn't really mean unlimited. So, but we've been living with it. It's fine. Except what happened this last month is I got an update at some point that broke my phone being able to get connected to Wi-Fi. It just broke it. And so I couldn't use Wi-Fi at home with my phone, my Galaxy S8. And I was looking on the message boards, and the message boards say, yeah, you know, it's a problem. There's some kind of a system update. It's not right. They're going to have to fix it, blah, blah, blah. Okay, fine. So I'm thinking, well, that's fine. I'm unlimited. So I just shut off my Wi-Fi because it wasn't working. Because I'm unlimited. So, you know, I'm at home, you know, watching videos on YouTube or this, that, and the other. You know, it's kind of okay. And then I start noticing like 2 days ago that all of a sudden it's taking a long time to get going. It's like, what is going on? And then today it was just abysmal. So I pop open. And I pop open my speed test, and my speed test is telling me that I'm only getting like 200 kilobits per second. Like, what? What? Because normally, when I pop open my speed test and I push the button, I mean, normally I'm getting like 17 megabits per second, 15 megabits per second. No. Less than 8 megabits per second, you know, and all of a sudden I'm getting 100 kilobits per second. Like, what in the world? So then I look at the amount of data I have used, and in fact, on my phone this last month, I used like 27 gigabytes of data. Yeah. Now, everything is going to reset in 6 days. So, for the next 6 days, I am in the gulag, is what it comes down to. Yeah. Unlimited. It's going to be unlimited until you use too much data. And then we're going to put you in the gulag. Okay. The only reason I'm in the gulag is because you broke my phone. So I just thought I'd call Verizon and just, you know, just see. I explained, you know, okay, you broke my phone. Oh, no, yeah, couldn't connect to Wi-Fi, did this. Yeah, that's the way it works. Okay, and there's no, that's just the way it works. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I will just sit in the gulag here and wait. Because I mentioned to the customer service rep, I said, you know, this is unusable. This is just, in this day and age, a 100K connection, you know, 200K connection to the internet is just pretty much unusable. But just yesterday, I got a system update, and so my phone does work on Wi-Fi now again. Yay, at home. So, it's a sad day, but as soon as I get home, we'll get this figured out. So, welcome to First World Problems. I landed the book. Boom. Last week, I had mentioned on Thursday, when I recorded the podcast, that I was writing like crazy. I actually took 2 days off work last week since I had already made budget. So I wrote 4,000 words on Wednesday, actually about 4,500, I think. And then I wrote 4,000 words on Thursday, and I wrote 4,000 words on Friday, and I wrote 4,000 words on Saturday. I was supposed to be done, but then I wrote another 3,000 words on Sunday and finally got the book landed. The problem is now, the most I think a book has come in about 500 pages in manuscript, which compresses down to somewhere around 420, 430. This book is 550 pages in manuscript. It is long. The most the books have been before is about 154,000 words. This book is 176 or 177. It is long. Oy. But I'm going through it now. I'm finding some stuff to cut out, but there's just not time to do a really hard edit and cut as much stuff as I would need to cut out. So now I'm having to sprint through the editing. Because, you know, there's, it was hard enough to edit up an 150,000 word book in the 2 weeks I give myself to do the editing. Yeah, getting that edited up in, you know, 175, 177,000 in that same, it's gonna push me a little, so that's fine. The happiness is, I have wandered out of the woods. So far, I've read through about 240 pages, somewhere in there. And it's fine. I've had to restructure a few things, but it's fine. It's fine. A lot of interesting gender stuff in it. Hopefully that will not offend too many readers, but, you know, you gotta talk about the important stuff in life. And it's landed, and the epilogue, I pronounce it good, so the epilogue does what it's supposed to do. So, yeah, I think I'm out of the woods. I won't know for sure until I finish reading through it for the first time, but I think I'm out of the woods on this one. So now it's a sprint for the next 2 or 3 weeks, and then hopefully, this car is making a lot of noise. hopefully, after the sprint, I'll actually get it put together, get it to betas, and then I turn around and drop back into the woods again, in the middle of the night, in the dense fog, and I start wandering my way back out. But it is going to be Book 8, The Counting House. Book 8 is called. This book is called Windfall Virgins. The next one is Windfall, The Counting House. And I kind of know where this book is supposed to end. Well, I do know where this book is supposed to end. Question is, I'm not exactly sure how I get there, but it will work out. I was telling a buddy, it's really interesting. I got to the epilogue. It was fine, got to the epilogue, got everything done I needed to get done, was ready to start the epilogue, and I knew what I wanted to happen, but there was a whole bunch of pieces about how is this going to happen, and I started in, and all of a sudden I started doing a backstory for one of the more minor characters in there, and I was like, why am I doing this backstory? But I just kept going, because I was like, no, we need to catch this up and figure this out. There were some things I didn't even know why in earlier books they had actually occurred. And so I figured that out as I was writing. It's like, oh, that's why she did that. But in the process of figuring out why she did that, that then gave me the setup to give me the environment to where I could get to where I needed to be at the end of the epilogue. It's just fascinating how that works out. You just keep putting one foot in front of the other until a little path opens up and you go, hey, I should go that direction. So it's just fascinating. It's fascinating stuff. Anyway, so the big thing now is just to edit, and then figure out what to do with the cover. I've been collecting pictures. I know what it's supposed to do. I think I've mentioned that the nursery rhyme that is tangentially referred to on the cover of this book is Froggy Went A-Courtin'. And so it's going to be fun. I've got a little Amish outfit with a hat, and so we're going to dress up my grandson as kind of the preacher, and then I've got a little lacy dress for my granddaughter that she's going to kind of be one of the bridesmaids, sort of. So I still have a lot of pieces to figure out what we're doing there, but it'll all come together. It will be fine. It will be just fine. Work is fine. Everything's puttering along at work. We're just setting things up, knocking them down, getting stuff done as fast as we can, trying to make sure the wheels stay on the cart, so, you know, all is well there. What else? I think that's about it. I came across, speaking of a topic for today, I came across a TED Talk. It was just on my recommended list. Came across a topic, and I thought, well, that looks pretty interesting, and so I started to listen to it, and I thought, this is different, this is interesting, and it was interesting enough that I actually texted a friend of mine who's in the management of the IT department at my major client, and I said, so what do you think about this for a way to manage? And he wrote me back, he said, where did you find this? I said, well, it was on my recommended list, and he came in to talk to me today, and he said he had watched it, and he said, that's really, I said, yeah, buddy, it's really interesting. So the name of the talk is How to Build a Company Where the Best Ideas Win. And this was by Ray Dalio, and he claims that whether you like it or not, radical transparency and algorithmic decision-making is coming at you fast, and it's going to change your life. That's because it's easy now to take algorithms and embed them into computers and gather all that data you're leaving on yourself all over the place. Okay, so he went and gave some of the background of himself, like when he was 12, you know, he got interested in the stock market, and so, you know, he gathered up some of his own money and he put it into the stock market and he bought some stocks that the only reason he bought them is because it was trading under $5. And he said, of course, that's a lousy reason to buy a stock. He said, but I tripled my money. And he said, and then I was hooked. And he said he's always been fascinated by how to predict the market, how to make money in the market, you know, because it was like this big puzzle that he was trying to crack, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then in the 70s, he made this big prediction about liquidity and about banks and how there was going to be a debt crisis. And so when the debt crisis came, then he kind of became famous. By the way, I know the car is making a lot of noise. I am taking it in tomorrow. I'm taking the car in tomorrow to get looked at and figure out what's going on. So I'm not going to keep driving it until the wheels fall off and I have an accident. So as long as I can get it into the mechanic tomorrow, we'll be good. Anyways, so then he appeared on some shows and, you know, they said, you're amazing and all that kind of stuff, except he had guessed that when there's this big debt crisis, that in fact the stock market would tank. And so he had bet against the stock market. And you know what? It didn't tank. And he lost gajillions of dollars, both of his own money and his client money. I mean, he just got wiped out. He said he had lost so much money that he had to borrow $4,000 from his dad just to pay some family bills. And he said it was one of the most painful experiences of his life. But it changed his life because it changed his attitude about decision making. And he wanted to come up with a better way to make decisions, to make sure that the best ideas floated to the top, come up with a way that he could run a true idea meritocracy, where it was the ideas, the best ideas, would be the ones that were embraced. So, one of the ways that they do this is what they call radical transparency. So everybody in his company has access to everybody else's emails. Now, I'm sure it's impossible for people to actually read everybody else's emails because they have jobs. But anybody can say anything to anybody that they want to. So he gave an example. He said, Jim Caskell, who works with me, he said he sent me an email the other day, and he said this was available to everybody in the company. He said, Ray, you deserve a D- for your performance in the meeting today. You did not prepare at all well, because there's no way you could have been that disorganized. And the head of the company said, isn't that great? He said, you know, we're actually getting real live input from our people that's honest. So to help with that type of thing, they've developed this system at his company that's called a dot collector. That's what he called it, a dot collector. So they have these meetings, joint meetings, where everybody is reacting, offering suggestions, yada, yada, yada. While other people are talking, the people who are listening are simultaneously grading the person who is talking. Grading them on how they're doing at that moment from 1 to 10. And they're attaching keywords to them. Like, well, I think they sound arrogant at the minute. Well, I think, you know, they don't have much empathy for other viewpoints at the minute. Well, I think this about them. I think that about them. I think they're doing a great job. I think whatever. And people are on their laptops and on their little tablets. And while the meeting is going on and ideas are being exchanged simultaneously, you've got everybody in the room who's making judgments about that. And then what that person can do after they make a judgment about that is they can zoom out and they can see how everyone else is feeling about this discussion as they're going. And they can go back in time, I'm back into my garage, and see how their decisions about certain things and about how they felt about them, how everybody else felt about them, and what was the decision that was eventually adopted, you know, based on how everybody felt about the decision. And so you've got this real-time analysis going on where everybody is supposedly being radically transparent about how they feel about these ideas, and whatever idea gains the most weight, that's the idea that's put forward. Now, he was also talking about that they also rank individuals on a, I think he called it a believability index. Like, these individuals, they were able to grade them in performance as to what best ideas won and how they felt about them or how other people felt about them. Anyways, it's this big algorithmic system where people are being radically transparent with each other. And he really sees this as the wave of the future. And he attributes this to the success of his company. And he said, you know, he pointed out one young lady who was in the meetings. He said, this is Jen. She's 24 years old, right out of college. And she can tell me, the CEO, that I'm approaching things terribly. He said, this tool helps people both express their opinions and then separate themselves from their opinions to see things from a higher level. So, you know, it's a really interesting idea that people are going to speak up and say what is on their mind about an interesting idea. As I was listening to this, I was thinking, well, you know, hey, you know, that I wouldn't mind this. This sounds pretty interesting. Because I like to think that if I have an idea that think it has merit, that I have reasoned my way through why that idea has merit, and that I can be fairly articulate in discussing why that idea has merit. And if other people have differing viewpoints, that's okay too. And I think I know enough about people that, you know, I can make people feel like they're being listened to because they are being listened to when I'm listening to them. So, you know, it would be very interesting to work in this kind of a company. But what was really fascinating to me about this was that he got to the end of it. He said, okay, so what's the problem with being radically truthful and radically transparent with each other? He said, people say it's emotionally difficult. Critics say it's a formula for a brutal work environment. Now, it depends on how you define brutal. So one of the things I talked to my buddy about is that my impression is that this type of a work environment would be much more difficult for women than for men. Because women, on average, in general, are consensus builders. They like to be involved in a process where we're encouraging each other and this kind of, yeah, you get it too. You know, that's I think, by nature would be a little tougher for a woman. Not for all women, but on average, in general. Because I can, you know, I can think across the work environments that I've had and the women who've been, and the men, women and men who've been involved in those, and I can certainly find people on both sides of the gender where I would say this would be a difficult work environment for that man and for this woman. And then I can find people that would say, you know, this woman would thrive in this type of environment and this guy would thrive. So it's not that, but average in general. But then he started talking about, he said, well, neuroscientists tell me that it has to do with our brains and our pre-wired, there's a part of our brain that would like to know our mistakes and like to look at our weaknesses so we could do better. And I'm told that's the prefrontal cortex. And then there's a part of our brain which views all of this as attacks. So until that, and that's the amygdala. In other words, there are two yous inside you. There's the emotional you and there's the intellectual you. And I'm thinking, well, that's pretty close. I personally would say there is the flesh and there is the spirit. But, you know, it's close. And he said, it's been our experience that we can win this battle and we win it as a group. And it takes about 18 months typically to find that most people prefer operating this way with this radical transparency than operating in a more opaque environment. There's not politics. There's not the brutality of you know it all that's hidden between the scenes. There's an idea meritocracy where people can speak, and that's been great, and it's given us more effective work, and if it's given us more effective relationship, and it's not for everybody, but we found that something like 25 or 30% of the population, it's just not. And then, by the way, when I say radical transparency, I'm not talking about saying, hey, you're bald. Anyway, so it's very interesting. It's very interesting. He thinks this is going to be the new wave of the future for for computers. And I could see that as computers and vision systems become better and better at reading facial tics and better at reading faces and moods, that land almighty, you're not even going to need people to tap on a dot collector. You're just going to need to get them on a room or even meeting with one or two people, and you're just going to scan their faces and say, yeah, okay, they're not very happy with this idea. And they're not very happy, period. Or they're really frustrated at the moment. Or whatever. So this is like a whole other new phase of what's coming. And one of the things that's interesting to me about this is that maybe this is either the reversal of what we see on social media, because what we see on social media is very curated. It's very, we try to present our best face. And a lot of times, well, we don't want to tell someone that we don't like something because then maybe they'll not like us back, you know. And we have these extremes of people that are trying to ameliorate and pacify on one side, and then we have these trolls over here on the other side in social media, and there's this gap between them. It would be very interesting if something like this could actually start to bring people together, make people more honest, and by the reactions they were getting, then also help them not be as brutal. This is really fascinating. It's really, really fascinating. So we'll see. Like I said, this might just be one more little thing coming down the pike from the amazing changes that are going to be taking place over the next 10 to 15 years. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home, even if I am still in the gulag when it comes to my phone. Sadness. First world problems. Have a great week.